Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the indictments of top FIFA officials by the Justice Department, FBI and IRS, and their pledge that they are only just beginning to cleanse the International Soccer Organization of its endemic and systemic corruption. Investigative reporter Andrew Jennings, the only reporter to be banned from FIFA President Sepp Blatter's press conferences and author of Omerta, Sepp Blatter's Organized Crime Family, joins us. Since Andrew helped the FBI with their investigations into FIFA, we will discuss how long it will be before the nine figures arrested today in Switzerland start ratting out their godfather, Sepp Blatter. Then we'll examine the Supreme Court taking up the case of Evenwall versus Abbott that will require states to draw their legislative districts according to the number of people registered or eligible to vote rather than the total population. Nationally recognized expert on election law and campaign finance, Richard Hassan, the Chancellor's Professor of Law at the University of California, Irvine, joins us to discuss how this case brought by conservatives could overturn the one-person, one-vote basis of our democracy by diluting the political clout of cities, shifting power to rural areas that vote Republican. Then finally, we'll look into the entry of Rick Santorum into the already crowded field of Republican presidential hopefuls and speak with Sarah Posner, senior editor at Religion Dispatches and author of God's Prophets, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values. We'll discuss whether the influence of the religious right in the early primaries will be diluted by Santorum, Cruz, Huckabee, and Walker, all competing for the same voters. And joining us now from the UK is Andrew Jennings, an investigative reporter best known for his work investigating and writing about corruption in the IOC and FIFA. Since March 2003, Andrew has been the only reporter in the world banned from FIFA President Sepp Blatter's press conferences. His books include Foul, The Secret World of FIFA, Bribes, Vote Rigging and Ticket Scandal. And his latest book is Omerta, Sepp Blatter's FIFA Organized Crime Family. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andrew Jennings.
Hello again, Ian.
And it does seem that Sepp Blatter's organized crime family, at least some members of the family, have been arrested by Swiss police at the behest of the United States Department of Justice. And they're talking about a systemic, the new attorney general talked about an ongoing criminal enterprise with systemic fraud, money laundering, $125 million in bribes have been paid. So explain, just to say, fill in the gaps there for us, since you've been following it.
I'm not a sports reporter, which is probably the important thing. Send me to the game, I might get the scoreline wrong.
Right.
I'm an investigator, and like investigative journalists, I look for sources and documents. I go looking for what they don't want. And I started with FIFA in 2002 when the scandal started to bubble up. And I realized after a while that FIFA, as I knew it in Europe, was an organized crime syndicate. It ticked all the boxes because I'm a bit of an expert on organized crime. I filmed with in Palermo. I've had a big man saying, "Hey, you're no film here," and he meant it. I left. So I've done organized crime before I ever looked at FIFA. Then, having figured out that Sepp Blatter was running an organization where the unaudited grants went down, the World Cup tickets go down, so these people who are voting on Friday as if it mattered now, and up comes absolute loyalty, as in a mafia organization, total loyalty, but the freedom to go out and steal, and that's what it's been. And I was in Rio a couple of years ago, because I go to Brazil quite often because of the football, and I was talking to some Brazilian journalists, and I said, "You know, I think they're organized crime." And they looked at me and said, "Don't you know, Andrew?" I said, "What are you talking about?" And they explained to me that the previous FIFA president, João Havelange, had been mobbed up in Rio before he ever came to Europe to take over the FIFA presidency. And they started telling me about the links to the gangster, big mafia man in Brazil, Castro Andrade, produced a wonderful photograph, which I put on my website. It's just like The Godfather. They've got the gangster, his daughter, it's her wedding, Havelange, and his son-in-law Ricardo Teixeira, who for years was one of the FIFA bosses. I mean, it's one of the great sporting pictures ever. And I realized then it was a global problem. And the FBI approached me. They said, "Will you help us?" Because I knew a lot about FIFA. So I said, yes. And I'm very pleased about today. It's been enough work, I can tell you.
But specifically, Andrew, how just taking the figure that was given by the Attorney General today, that those that are arrested so far have been accused of paying more than $150 million in bribes and kickbacks in exchange for media deals associated with major soccer tournaments. Exactly what is the methodology here? How do these guys take care of themselves in this organized crime family known as FIFA?
It's not one single operation. There's all kinds of ways you can extort money. If you've got something of value, which is a sports event, you can extort money from all over the media, from marketing companies you never heard of. One of them, you notice Nike's come up because of the Brazilian scandal, and that one is going to take off. How did Nike get their wonderful exclusive contract with the very, very corrupt Brazilian Federation? That one's going to run well. But it goes through ticket rackets, backhanders on awarding events. Like we all know, something very stinky happened when America was defeated by Qatar for the World Cup. A strip of sand in impossible temperatures. How did that happen? Well, I think we're going to hear that in the court soon, because I see that, for instance, Jack Warner from Trinidad is indicted. Jack knows about every bribe that was ever paid. But there's all sorts of ways. And there's things been going on in Brazil, things been going on at FIFA headquarters, things around the world, and they're lumping it together, and good luck to them.
So far, though, they haven't managed to get to Sepp Blatter, the godfather, if you will.
Well, that's what they say. They put out this statement today. Well, you know, as I know, every time there's a big court case, the lawyer stands outside and says, they're completely innocent, they're not involved, and then they go to jail, of course. Blatter has been in the middle of this. If he didn't know, he's deaf, dumb and blind. I've not denounced him, I've revealed much about him on BBC television over the last 6 years in big documentary, investigative documentaries. Of course he knew. You can't have all this going on around you when you're a micromanager. Was he taking money? Let's wait and see. But, you know, they can't arrest everybody on day one. And, of course, what's going to happen now, I was told this by an FBI man, not involved in the case, involved in other actions last year. He said, you know, they'll roll over one by one when they're indicted. They're going to be rushing to beat the man next to them to turn themselves over and be a cooperating witnesses with the Justice Department. And let's wait and see. But Sepp Blatter's known. If he's only just watched my documentaries, he's known. But, of course, micromanager, there since 1976. Come on, he knows.
And again,
he's worse.
And again, I'm speaking with Andrew Jennings, who is in the UK. He's an investigative reporter, best known for his work investigating and writing about corruption in the IOC and FIFA. Since March 2003, Andrew has been the only reporter in the world banned from FIFA President Sepp Blatter's press conferences. His books include Foul, The Secret World of FIFA, Bribes, Vote Rigging, and Ticket Scandal. And his latest book is El Muerta, Sepp Blatter's FIFA Organized Crime Family. So given what the FBI man told you, I think that is a pretty accurate prediction, and certainly a well-proven methodology of getting criminals to squeal on their fellow criminals. I would think also the people who were strong-armed into paying these bribes maybe they weren't very happy about having to do it, particularly giving lots of money to these sleazy functionaries.
Already in the indictments today, there's at least one Brazilian businessman who's been involved in this. And he has given back, apparently, $150 million. That's a lot of money to repay. So, yes, you're quite right. Some of the businessmen who paid the bribes are going to be thinking, I don't want to go to prison in America. The prisons aren't very nice. And so they'll be talking. And this is Mr. Havila of the Traffic Organization, which is a huge marketing group, grew fantastically because of connected to certain FIFA officials. He's talking. He's a cooperating witness. He's paid money back. This is very bad news because he also worked in America with CONCACAF. He knows a lot about corruption in American football. It's going to be fun, Mister. I'll see you in the press box.
Well, one of the most corrupt countries in the world, it's led by a kind of godfather who regulates organized crime and has a kind of, they call them the Siloviki, these former intelligence officers now turned oligarchs is, of course, Vladimir Putin. And he's already jumping on this, saying that this is all an American scandal, an American conspiracy.
Aren't they boring? Aren't crooks boring when they blame other people? I mean, we know that something very dirty happened, because it's not just Putin. These guys at the FIFA Executive Committee have a history of soliciting bribes. And indeed, the English FA president, David Drysman, Lord David Drysman, he's not a real lord, you know, they just gave him the title, as he's a politician. David gave evidence to what we call a select committee, similar to your committees in America, where on oath he denounced Jack Warner, Ricardo Teixeira, Makudi from Thailand, and Nicholas Lales from Paraguay, for trying to shake down the English bid for 2018. Now, they were doing it again. I've reported it, and so Germany reported it. The bribes were paid in 2000 for Germany to get the 2006 World Cup. It happens every time. They've got their hands out, and some bid committees in countries that aren't very clean will pay. So we're suspicious the moment anybody gets it anyway. And the very fact that the Russian oligarchs thought it was going to be Sochi all over again, fantastic amounts of money to skim. And Doha, do you want to play football in a sandpit?
Well,
you know, it's just a joke. Just, you know, it's not a joke, right. It's a sick joke. And, of course, the result is that you buy a Coca-Cola and you pay the cost of another coffin going from Doha back to Nepal with a dead worker in it. It's outrageous, absolutely outrageous. World Cup built on dead bodies.
Well, of course, the Russian World Cup is 2018. It precedes the sandbox, if you will. But in terms of what the Russians are saying, they're saying 13 U.S. senators sent an appeal to FIFA President Sepp Blatter back in beginning of April, saying that they thought that they should remove the 2018 World Cup from Russia because of Russia's invasion.
Yeah, I saw my old friend John McCain did that. But you see, that's a sidebar. With great, great respect, nobody cares what a bunch of American senators have got to say about the World Cup in another country, yeah? I mean, I'm glad they said it, but it doesn't have any effect. What does matter is that Putin did what was needed on that day that the two World Cups were voted on. And stop and think. You don't vote on two International Olympic Committee games in one day, in one afternoon. There's no need to vote on two FIFA World Cups. It was put together by the old boys so they could get more bribes extorted from it. Now, Russia was happy, whoever paid the money, probably the oligarchs, not Putin, because they thought it would be another Sochi, lots of money to steal. And then two things happen. The oil price goes through the floor, as we all know, and the Crimean adventure brings sanctions. And suddenly the Russians are having trouble. They've cut back on a number of stadia, they've cut back on a number of hotels. And I talked to my friends in America, travel agents who get World Cup tickets. They say all their clients from America are happy to go to Moscow and St. Petersburg. They're not going to fly on dubious Russian airlines the other side of the Urals. So they're in trouble. Mr. Putin would actually be quite pleased if it was taken away from Russia. He could protest and think, God, because you see, all they can afford is a shabby World Cup.
Well,
and that doesn't look too good, does it?
Well, but Sepp Blatter went to Moscow recently and met with... to the Summer Palace.
Who cares what Sepp Blatter says about anything? He's run a crooked organisation for the last 20-odd years. Where he went and what he said really doesn't matter anymore. What matters is what the American judicial system is going to do, and it's going to jail a lot of them, and he's not in the clear. This is sports reporting. Well, he said, Sepp Blatter said he's innocent. Sepp Blatter said, we don't care what he said. We want to see the evidence. You
right.
See what I mean?
Moving
on past that.
Well, one question, though, that has nothing to do with sports reporting is why did the Swiss authorities move, do you think, given that Sepp Blatter is a Swiss citizen?
They've laid back for years. I mean, there's some clean Swiss investigators have done a very good job over the years, but they've never nailed them. There's been a reluctance because, remember, Switzerland's had such bad publicity over the Holocaust, gold, all kind of dirty bank accounts, and I think they were reluctant to do another one. But then I remember I was talking with the FBI about 4 years ago, talking with one of the special agents out of New York, and I said to him, look, you know, I can tell you so much, but you've got to go and talk to this particular, very clean, very clever investigator in Switzerland who's looking into FIFA. You've got to do it through mutual assistance. And he said, we've done it. At that point, I thought, the game is up. Because once they're into Switzerland, the Swiss are going to be embarrassed. Just like, you know who's going to be really, really embarrassed? The most embarrassed American? Mr. Michael Garcia, who was paid $6 million by FIFA, the former US attorney, to investigate them. And he couldn't find anything wrong. And he resigned in a hurry last November, December, when he realised the FBI were coming in, and they've done it. They've got him, and he didn't. Yet he keeps telling sports reporters, oh, well, it's the fuddy-duddy Europeans, you know, we're open in America. Okay, let's see what evidence he really found. And they have this Garcia report, which is going to be published one day. It'll never be published because there's nothing in it. It's not a smoking gun. He didn't get the evidence. He got well paid. I mean, it's historic, isn't it? We all have this problem of gangsters paying the policemen. And here, Blatter paid this law firm run by Michael Garcia millions of dollars to investigate them. And guess what? They didn't find anything.
Well, it would seem, though, that given what took place with the arrests of nine FIFA officials in Switzerland and the high-profile press conference announcements by the Attorney General, the head of the IRS's investigative division, who said called FIFA the World Cup of fraud, and he said we're handing FIFA a red card.
Yeah, build more jails. Free some prisoners. Make space.
So you can see that it's closing in on them, but they're all meeting in Zurich because they have their Congress. Their annual Congress of FIFA, and they're electing a new president or not, or keeping Sepp Blatter on.
Not an election as you would know it, because one does sometimes criticize American electoral processes, but the president doesn't actually go out and bribe, you know, millions of Americans with bundles of cash to vote for him. That doesn't happen. And that's what's happened at FIFA. All these tame delegates from countries that most of us couldn't find on the map, but have the same vote as America, Brazil, Argentina, England, Germany, France, and so on. That's been his racket. Tiny little countries with no professional football are given FIFA membership, and they get $1 million a year development grants, which are not audited. Are you getting the picture? So, we don't care what they vote. They can vote for Father Christmas if they want.
Right.
After the arrest today, we don't care. If they do vote for him, well, I think the clean federations, particularly Europe, which give a lot of money to the developing world, will just say, you want to vote for Blatter? Go and ask him for money because you're not getting ours. And there'll be great pressure from Europe on that. We've had enough of Blatter. But I think, you know, he sees nobody from today. He presides over empty chairs. And when they have their Congress the rest of this week, I hope the TV news cameras focus on the empty chairs.
And what about this Jordanian prince that's the runner-up?
Prince Ali is straight. I say that for him. He doesn't take money. He doesn't know very much. And he was going to lose his job at FIFA because his time was up if he didn't stand. And he stood rather desperately. Now, I don't think the crooks have always voted for Blatter. I think they're so thick in it. They won't say, oh, right, let's switch the vote to Prince Ali. It could happen, but I don't think it will.
So
he needs to stay president so he can control the process.
So is it possible then with this scandal-ridden organization run by the Godfather, who's still trying to dodge the bullets and even praise the arrest and investigation by the U.S. and Swiss authorities, could this organization implode since it's all based on graft?
Well, I think it will because there'll be the evidence at the extradition hearing. Some of them surely will fight extradition, knowing that they're going to go to Rikers Island when they arrive in New York. I mean, that's not very nice. So they're fighting. There's a chance. You hope you might win in court. They might not send you. Then when they get sent, they can enjoy Rikers Island and the regime there, and then we'll get the evidence in court. So it's going to go on, just drip, 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 drip. It's not all over today. It's barely started today. And indeed, the Department of Justice people were as good as saying this today, that there's more to come. So Sepp Blatter's not out of the woods at all. But what you need in America now is you've had the most appalling leadership in soccer. Mr. Sunil Gulati doesn't take bribes. He's not corrupt. When did he ever say a word? Yeah, when Chuck Blazer, who I gave the IRS and the feds the stuff to take him out, they did. Sunil takes over representing America and has never said a word since. Doesn't want to talk. Now, I think Sunil should say, I've failed. I'm not corrupt, but I haven't delivered as I should do to the fans. I'm going back to teaching economics at Columbia and leave me alone, please. And then, from grassroots upward, you start a whole new organization dominated by fans and perhaps clubs, but certainly fans, not these elite figures who fly around the world in expensive leather seats and never see the fans and love going to Europe and to Switzerland. You've been betrayed in America. As I say, no one's suggesting that Mr. Galati's taken money, been bribed, anything like that. But he's been silent, and that is a crime when corruption goes on around you. To be silent is disgusting. So come on, American football, chuck him out and get some decent people, because we need decent FBI people and decent football officials, and you can do both.
Well, Andrew Jennings, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Andrew Jennings, who's an investigative reporter best known for his work investigating and writing about corruption in the IOC and FIFA. Since March 2003, Andrew has been the only reporter in the world banned from FIFA President Sepp Blatter's press conferences. His books include Foul, The Secret World of FIFA, Bribes, Vote Rigging, and Ticket Scandal. And his latest book is Omuerta, Sepp Blatter's FIFA Organized Crime Family. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into a new case the Supreme Court has just taken up that could overturn the one person, one vote basis of our democracy. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Richard Hassan, who's the Chancellor's Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of California, Irvine. He's a nationally recognized expert on election law and campaign finance regulation, and is the co-author of a leading casebook on election law. He served as a founding co-editor of the quarterly peer-reviewed publication Election Law Journal, and he's the author of more than 80 articles on election law issues. His latest book is The Voting Wars, From Florida 2000 to the Next Election Meltdown. Andy has an article at Slate, Only Voters Count. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Hassan.
Good to be with you.
And the fact that the Supreme Court has taken up this case brought by two Texas voters, and what's at stake here is that this ruling could shift the political power from cities to rural areas across the United States, a move that would clearly benefit Republicans. What makes me nervous is we've seen this movie before with the Supreme Court, you know, with Citizens United, an obscure political operative brings a case forth and they blow up the entire hundreds of years of election laws. Is it possible that this is a repeat of that?
Well, it could only blow up about 50 years of election law, if that's any consolation, because these rules only go back to the 1960s. I think there's reason to worry, although not panic, that the court could mandate counting voters when you create districts rather than counting total population, which, as you said, would benefit rural areas and Republicans because urban areas tend to have more non-citizens, more children, and this especially in places like California would hurt Latino representation. It's not clear what the Supreme Court's going to do based on the fact that it took this case. There are reasons it may have taken the case not to necessarily change the rules as they are now, which gives states discretion as to how to divide up their districts. But there is cause for concern.
Well, already we have, with the fact that small states have the same number of senators as large states, so there's already a kind of an imbalance or a favoring of rural areas built into the Constitution, isn't there?
Well, there is for less populated states. There is on the Senate level. What's at stake in the Evanwell case is how lines are to be drawn for state districts, for state legislative districts. So in California, we'd be talking about the California Assembly, the California State Senate. It's possible that this decision could be extended to the drawing of congressional districts within states, although I think it's unlikely that it would be extended to anything to do with apportionment, figuring out how many representatives each state would get. That's subject to different rules under the Constitution. So really right now what we're talking about is state-level representation and the districts that are drawn to elect state representatives.
So explain to us, if you will, Richard Hasson, how this would be a departure from the idea of one person, one vote.
Sure. So back in the 1960s, the Supreme Court first recognized this idea of which we now call one person, one vote, which is basically the idea that people have to be put into roughly equal populations when they're assembled into districts for choosing representatives. And the reason for this one person, one vote rule is so that you don't have, as we had before in California, where you could, if you had representation by each county, you'd have a large county like Los Angeles that would have much less representation than small counties, so hardly populated areas, because each voter would have less voting power in the large areas than in the small areas. And so back in the 1960s, when it came to state elections, the Supreme Court, in a case called Reynolds versus Sims, said you had to draw roughly equally populated districts. Once the court said that, there was a question as to equal in terms of what? What is the denominator? Are you looking at total population? Are you looking at total number of voters? How are you going to decide this? And in a 1966 case called Burns versus Richardson out of Hawaii, the Supreme Court said that choice is really up to the states. But there are different political theories about how to do representation, and within the one-person, one-vote rule, we're not going to dictate the form of the denominator. And this, I take it, is pretty much an attack on this Burns rule, which had been reaffirmed by the court, and all of the earlier attacks in the courts of appeal on this rule had been rejected, with court saying the total population is a permissible basis for doing this. And now the court is wading into this question about whether the only denominator that is appropriate is something based on either eligible or actual voters rather than the total population of an area.
So are the consequences then clear that if the Conservatives win, and the ones that brought this case forth, and assuming that the Conservatives on the Supreme Court agree with them, that districts should be divided according to the number of people registered or eligible to vote as opposed to the total populations. How does it affect the outcome in the sense that even though you have more populations in the cities, including non-citizens, children, people that have been charged with felonies and have become ineligible to vote, etc., they represent the total population, but they can't vote. So what is the distinction here? That I'm trying to understand, not that I'm agreeing with the conservative argument, but I'm trying to understand what the other argument is.
So what's the theory behind why it must be total voters?
Yes.
That's the question?
Yes.
Well, the argument is that this dilutes the vote of voters, people who are eligible to vote. And so the example
that
the plaintiffs give in the Evanwell case is they say, look, you could take two districts in Texas, a district that has a lot of non-citizens in it, and certainly I think the plaintiffs are motivated by animus or at least discomfort with non-citizens being counted here. You take two districts, one that has a lot of non-citizens, one that does not have a lot of non-citizens, and what you find is that you have a dilutive effect. You have more voters in the district that have fewer non-citizens in it, and so their voting power is less than those voters or in those districts where there are a lot of non-citizens or people otherwise ineligible to vote. And so they're claiming a kind of vote dilution, and they're saying it's not fair to voters to treat you in this way.
And the fact that this is Arizona State Legislature versus Arizona Independent Redistricting Commission, there's established biases there against immigrant populations.
Well, there are two cases, right?
Right.
So the Evanwell case, the one that the Supreme Court just agreed to hear yesterday, is actually out of Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And in Texas, there are areas with a large Hispanic population, and this would be a way to create even more gains for Republicans in especially rural areas in Texas, so they'd get more representation because the people in these districts who are either children or immigrants who don't have voting rights would not count. The other case, the case the Supreme Court is expected to decide within the next month or so, is a case out of Arizona. That's the case that attacks the ability to draw congressional districts using independent redistricting commissions. And the claim there is that only the state legislature can draw the lines for congressional elections. And that decision could come any time between now and the end of June.
And isn't that similar to what happened here in California in the way that redistricting was brought about?
Yes, it is similar to California, but there's a big partisan difference. And so in Arizona, the Republicans are very unhappy with independent redistricting. They think it's depriving them of the ability to get the spoils of having the legislature draw the districts. However, in California, Republicans are happier with independent redistricting because they think that even though it's not a perfect system, it's better than a Democratic gerrymander, which is what we have seen in the past, where Democrats control the legislature. If they control the governorship, better to have an independent commission drawing the lines. So that one doesn't necessarily work in the same partisan way in each jurisdiction. Both cases, the Arizona case and the Texas case, have in common the idea that you have these conservatives who are bringing lawsuits which would ironically limit states' rights, limit the state's ability to decide how they want to structure their political systems, whether they want to take self-interest out of the equation for drawing district lines in the Arizona case, whether they want to have a sense of what political representation means to include all people when they draw district lines. And if these suits are successful, states would have fewer choices as to how they structure their political systems.
And again, I'm speaking with Richard Hassan, who's the Chancellor's Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of California, Irvine. He's a nationally recognized expert in election law and campaign finance regulation and is the co-author of a leading casebook on election law. He served as founding co-editor of the quarterly peer-reviewed publication Election Law Journal, and he's the author of more than 80 articles on election law issues. And his latest book is The Voting Wars, From Florida 2000 to the Next Election Meltdown. And he has an article at Slate, Only Voters Count. So this, of course, would be following on this Supreme Court decision, assuming that it comes down the way that at least I fear it might, and that's just based upon the president of Citizens United, which wasn't so much about voting, but it's given the Republicans an enormous advantage financially with plutocrats being able to pour in unlimited amounts of money that are unaccountable. And then shortly thereafter, there was the case to overturn important preclearance provisions in the Voting Rights Act that's also had a very identifiable manifest outcome, has it not? I mean, so is there a concern here that the highest court in the land is operating in a sense as an extension of the Republican Party in order to make them competitive or keep them competitive by fair means or foul? Because obviously the Republicans are losing the demographic battle because they have not been particularly inviting to the growing Latino demographic.
Yeah, I don't believe that's the case. I don't believe that the justices on the Supreme Court are voting in a crassly partisan way. What I do believe is that they vote in an ideological way and that those who are ideologically conservative are most likely to be the ones chosen by Republican presidents to serve on the Supreme Court. And this ideology lines up with the interests of the Republican Party. Although, there are some who thought that getting rid of the preclearance provisions of the Voting Rights Act would hurt the Republican Party because it would get rid of some safer majority-minority districts, which actually allowed for the packing of minority voters. So the partisan aspects here, I think, are not as blatant as you suggest, although the partisan effects may well be. I believe that these justices are voting based upon their sincere views as to how to properly interpret the Constitution. But I think that, as with the liberals on the court as well, their ideology affects how they see the Constitution and how they see the political system. There is reason to think, though, that the court may not have taken this case to change these last 50 years of precedent. And that's because this case came up in an unusual way. Usually when cases come to the Supreme Court, they come up on a what's called a cert petition, which begins in the federal side, at least, with a federal district court decision followed by a court of appeals decision, and then the Supreme Court can take the case or not. And when the court decides not to take the case, that means nothing. You can't point to that to say the court thinks the lower court was right or anything like that. But this was an unusual case. Certain redistricting cases and certain campaign finance cases come up to the Supreme Court directly from a three-judge district court on an appeal. And when the Supreme Court decides not to take one of those cases, that is precedential, and it means that the lower court got the result right. Perhaps not the reasoning, but the result right. And so in cases like this, what we've seen is the court feels more of an obligation to take the cases and have a full hearing on the question. And it may be that that's all that's going on in this case, and that the court will simply reaffirm its rule from the 1960s that states can choose their form of representation. And there's a very practical reason why the Supreme Court might do this, might side not with the challengers, but with the state of Texas. And that is that we do not have very good empirical information on the number of citizens within each district. And so if we were going to draw district lines based only on eligible voters, it would be a lot of guesswork, and it would be much less precise than what we have now. You know, the U.S. Census is pretty good at counting people, but we don't do the same kind of counting of eligible voters. And so there's a very practical reason why it would open up a whole can of worms if we moved to this other kind of system of counting. So that's why I'm nervous, but I'm not pessimistic at this point about how things are going to go in this case.
But Richard Hazen, when you say this is not about crass partisanship, but about ideology, I'm trying to identify the ideology. Now, we know that from going back to the Founding Fathers, that the first instinct was to only have white men of property vote in a kind of timocracy where the property owners essentially run the show. And that, of course, there's been a struggle to broaden the mandate out over the centuries. So that seems to be in the sort of DNA, if you like. But one of the things that struck me about the speech that was caught on tape of Mitt Romney's that probably cost him, certainly didn't cost him the election, it certainly cost him quite a bit in that last go-around in the presidential elections, the idea that there's the makers and the takers, that the Democrats are really out there just sort of fishing for minority votes just to get the numbers, and that on the other hand, there are these eligible voters who vote regularly and who are the sort of upstanding citizens as opposed to the takers, they're the makers, and that they have to be defended. I've actually had conversations with conservatives who have made this argument that somehow the Democrats are really are looking for just to bribe people to vote, which is pretty much what Mitt Romney was saying. So I know I'm flaying about here, but I'm trying to find the identifiable ideology that we're talking about here.
Sure. Well, let's talk about the Arizona case. So if you look at the Arizona case, the argument for why you could not have independent redistricting commissions is a textual one. If you look at the Constitution, it says that in terms of congressional elections, the rules are to be done by the legislature of each state. And so the argument in favor of ruling for the challengers in the Arizona case is legislature means legislature. The word is in the Constitution. That's the word that we should use. And there's a theory of originalism, a theory of textualism, which conservatives on the Supreme Court tend to apply, to read the words quite literally. It's the same issue that's coming up in the Obamacare case, which we're also expecting to be decided within the next few weeks. And I think you can be a principled conservative and say we're going to have strict rules for interpretation of statutes, strict rules for interpretation of the meaning of the words of the Constitution, and use that to reach a result which is, in this case, in both of these cases, ones that would benefit the Republican Party. I don't think that means that these rules of textualism or originalism are being chosen for that reason, but I would say more that the people who are the justices on the Supreme Court were chosen because this is their ideology. And so I would see the causation in a somewhat different way. I do not believe that in most cases the justices of the court, whether they're liberal or conservative, are considering the what's best for the political party that they were in when they're deciding how to vote in these cases.
And, of course, in order to get the 13 states to sign on in terms of the first Congress, one of the preconditions was that the states had to have run their own voting systems, and we've been stuck with that. And I'm trying to figure out why it is that the Supreme Court gets to decide, and yet the intention of the Constitution was always to give the states the rights to conduct their own elections.
Well, we've been having this debate since the 1960s, and you can go back to the one-person, one-vote rule itself. And, you know, if you think back to what it was like before that rule came in, where Los Angeles was grossly underrepresented in the state legislature and the interests of rural areas were being outvoted, you know, so many people, including me, think it was good that the Supreme Court intervened to create some kind of rough equality on that point. And so once we're going to have the court in what Justice Frankfurt called the political thicket, there's just going to be a question of what the rules are going to be. And it turns out that liberals and conservatives have different views as to what's the appropriate role of the courts in policing these rules, and different, I think, understandings of what should be a question left to the political branches and what should be a question that should be decided by the courts.
Well, Richard Hassan, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Richard Hassan, who's the Chancellor's Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of California, Irvine. He's a nationally recognized expert in election law and campaign finance regulation, and is the co-author of a leading casebook on election law. He serves as a founding co-editor of the quarterly peer-reviewed publication Election Law Journal, and his latest book is The Voting Wars, From Florida 2000 to the Next Election, and he has an article at Slate, Only Voters Count. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the entry of Rick Santorum into the already crowded field of Republican presidential hopefuls. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Sarah Posner, who's a senior editor at Religion Dispatches and the author of God's Prophets, that's P-R-O-F-I-T-S, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values. Her work has appeared in The American Prospect, The Nation, Salon, The Washington Spectator, and the religion blogs at The Washington Post and The Guardian. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sarah Posner.
Thanks, Ian.
And the entry of Rick Santorum into the already crowded Republican presidential primary races doesn't come as a surprise, because it seems like he's a perennial candidate. What does he do with his downtime when he's not running for president?
He has a political organization that he ran between the two presidential races that he jumped in on. And, you know, he pretty much talks about morality and Christianity and the dangers of radical Islam. That's pretty much what I detected him doing between 2012 and now. And he also, I think, had a launched some kind of movie studio that made Christian movies, religious movies.
I see. So he doesn't, I imagine running for president gives him a lot of visibility and keeps those other businesses humming along.
I think that's right. You know, I think that for him, he's got to look at this field and wonder, you know, is there a way for me to break out of single digits here with Mike Huckabee and Marco Rubio and Scott Walker and Jeb Bush, and you look, the list goes on and on and on and on, and it's not really clear how Santorum, who hasn't been in the Senate for some years now, I think 2006 was when he got out of the Senate, you know, what he brings to the table that will make him competitive with these other candidates. It's not at all clear to me.
Well, in Iowa, in the caucuses back in 2012, of course, he was a surprise winner. And he did actually do pretty well throughout the Republican primaries. Yet, it was polling at 1%, but, you know, he won a few states. So that was always a bit of a disconnect.
Well, I think that he definitely in 2012, he appealed to a particular kind of voter. He emphasized a lot of issues near and dear to the religious right. In 2012, he was particularly focused on the quote-unquote religious freedom issues, particularly surrounding the Hobby Lobby case, the contraception coverage under the Affordable Care Act. And he distinguished himself in that primary by probably being one of the more backward candidates on whether contraception should be available. But this time around, I think that he sees a different landscape. He's definitely trying to put himself out there as the populist candidate, the candidate who's going to campaign for the little guy and not the big money of Republican Party politics. But I don't know that that's really going to get him anywhere. I think he's banking on the goodwill he established in Iowa. He went to every county in Iowa when he campaigned in the caucuses there. But I'll tell you, you know, I was in Iowa for the caucuses in 2012, and while yes, he did win, he won by a hair, and there was a lot of support for other candidates or other kinds of Republican candidates, particularly Ron Paul. So I don't know how that's going to translate for Rand Paul. And we still don't know how some of these newcomers to the field, like Rubio and Walker, are going to do with the Iowa caucus goers.
Well, he's up against a former Baptist preacher, Mike Huckabee. He's up against the sons of two preachers, Governor Scott Walker and Senator Ted Cruz. So it's getting to be a pretty crowded field in terms of slicing and dicing the religious right vote. And, of course, you've got the retired neurosurgeon Ben Carson as well, who wears his religion on his sleeve as well.
And he's pretty popular with evangelicals, although I have to say that I think for some evangelicals his lack of experience holding public office is a negative factor for him running for president, even though they have a lot of admiration for him. I think a lot of evangelicals are going to look at Scott Walker and see him as somebody who they think might be able to win, who understands them, number one. Number two, can win a general election since he's won three elections in 4 years in a blue state, essentially, or a purple state in Wisconsin. They like the way they think he faced down the public sector unions there. And he's been working hard at their issues, making it clear that he's on their side on their issues like abortion and same-sex marriage. And then obviously like Huckabee's in, Cruz is in, Rubio is definitely trying to appeal to the religious right. Rand Paul is trying in his own way to do that. So you're right. It's a very crowded field. A lot of the candidates have recent governing experience, particularly Walker, less so Bush. The candidates who are in the Senate right now do. And for someone like Santorum, he's a bit of a has-been, and he hasn't held public office at all in, I think by the time the election rolls around, you know, it will be 10 years.
And again, I'm speaking with Sarah Posner, who's a senior editor at Religion Dispatches and author of God's Prophets, that's P-R-O-F-I-T-S, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values. Her work has appeared in The American Prospect, The Nation Salon, The Washington Spectator, and the religion blogs at The Washington Post and The Guardian. So choosing this odd backdrop to make his presidential announcement, Rick Santorum, stood in front of Penn United Technologies, which is manufactures equipment for oil and gas industries. It's apparently a company, according to its website, was founded as a Christian company. And its motto is that we exist to glorify God. In terms of glorifying God, oil and gas companies, in the context of global warming, are not exactly, adding to the glory of God if they're responsible for choking the planet to death.
Right. Well, that's interesting that he would do that, because I think that this is part and parcel of the religious liberty campaign that has been, that we saw in the last GOP primary in 2012, has been very much part of the Hobby Lobby litigation and related litigation. And the idea is that religious liberty isn't just about, you know, your right to go to church and worship as you please, or worship as you please in your own home, but that it's also very much about, quote-unquote, living out your faith in the sphere of business. And those two things are very closely tied together for a lot of religious conservatives. They wouldn't see it the way you just described it, with oil companies contributing to global warming. They see it as, well, you know, this is a hard-working, family-run business where they are glorifying God by making money.
Well, the religious liberty issue that you brought up, Sarah Pazin, of course, is going to continue, and it's alive and well in terms of litigation across the country, and certainly the Hobby Lobby case opened the door for it. The other case that evangelicals are watching closely, that will probably be announced in late June. Is the gay marriage issue, which, of course,
right.
Rick Santorum is one of the most ardently opposed to. My sense is that this is a very political court, and that John Roberts, the Chief Justice, is in many ways the number one Republican political operative in the country. And I think what they're going to do is get these Republicans off the hook, because they're fighting against a demographic tide, not just in terms of Latinos, but also in terms of the general attitudes of acceptance towards gay marriage across the country. And it seems to me that it's likely that the Supreme Court will rule to legalize gay marriage and essentially get these candidates off the hook. That's my interpretation.
I don't know that it will get them off the hook in the primary, because I think that if the Supreme Court, and I agree with you, it seems likely that the Supreme Court will rule that there is a constitutional right to same-sex marriage. And I think if the Supreme Court rules that way, the candidates will be under pressure from the base to articulate how they are going to, quote-unquote, protect Christians who are opposed to same-sex marriage, and protect their religious freedom as they see it. They see it as creating the potential to violate their religious freedom by, you know, requiring, you know, bakers and florists to supply flowers and cakes to same-sex weddings and so on and so forth, everything that we heard in relation to these state religious freedom laws. So I think, and this is just based on my own reporting and talking to evangelical voters, they really want to hear the candidates articulate what they would do to protect their religious liberty, and not just in the context of same-sex marriage, but they think that there could be other ways in which the government will force them to violate their religious convictions, such as the contraception coverage. So I don't think it gets them off the hook. I think that it will place them in a similarly unpopular position for the general election by pressuring them to talk about it in this religious liberty context, which will also be unpopular with general election voters. And so they're going to have to really figure out a way, how are they going to satisfy the base on this without completely coming across to general election voters as being behind the times. I mean, honestly, you know, if you look at polling data on this, there is one demographic group that is still opposed to same-sex marriage, and that's white evangelicals. But even among millennial white evangelicals, they're reaching almost like 50% in favor. So it's an increasingly unpopular position. They're trying to make it seem like, well, yeah, sure, we understand it's an unpopular position, but we're the vanguard of the Orthodox Christianity, and we're trying to maintain our religious liberty in the face of all of these changes. That's the kind of pressure the candidates are going to be under from the religious right voters.
But surely, Sarah Posner, what happened to Mike Pence in Indiana, he was kind of putting out feelers to run for president,
yes.
And he was pandering to the religious right by passing this so-called religious liberty law that totally
right.
blew up in his face. I mean, he had the whole business community and thousands of people showing up demonstrating, and he was clearly, he was like a deer in the headlights. He didn't realize what happened, and I imagine that lesson's going to be resounding, isn't it, across the political? I mean, how pragmatic are these people?
Not that pragmatic. I think that they're going to see Pence as the victim of the particular circumstances in Indiana, which was that there were businesses and the NCAA and NASCAR and whoever else was concerned about this from a business standpoint. And because the law was so poorly drafted and so clearly permitted discrimination, he was backed into a corner. These guys are going to try to figure out a different way of talking about it because, of course, if they're elected president, they're not going to be passing state laws. They're just going to be talking about how they feel about these issues and signaling to the base that they understand their cultural concerns. That's what the base wants to hear. I mean, yes, they want to hear specific policy proposals, but they're also kind of satisfied just to get the sense that culturally speaking, the candidates understand where they're coming from and understand that they feel besieged by these changes, particularly with regard to LGBT rights. And so I don't think that they'll be backed into the same sort of corner that Pence was, but they're going to struggle to find the right way to phrase this that won't make other voters think that they're completely backward.
Well, that's always the problem, isn't it, with these primaries? You have one constituency in the primaries, and in the general you have a much different one, and you often are trapped by what you say in the primaries.
Right. But you have to remember that a lot of voters aren't completely motivated on these sorts of issues. There are a lot of voters out there who would be more motivated by, say, economic issues or national security issues or foreign policy concerns. So, they're hoping to balance all of that, and we'll see.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Sarah Posner.
Happy to do it, Ian.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Sarah Posner, who's a senior editor at Religion Dispatches and the author of God's Prophets, that's Profits, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values. Her work has appeared in The American Prospect, The Nation, Salon, The Washington Spectator, and the religion blogs at The Washington Post and The Guardian. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.